Acts 27, if you want to join me there. Actually, we're going to probably just be at the very last three or four verses of Acts 26 to kind of set up our study this morning. So Acts 27, we're going to finish up over the next 2 weeks our journey through Acts. It's taken us almost a year now, but a year of great understanding and understanding of knowledge of what the church is supposed to be. But Acts 26, verse 30, and then we're going to walk through briefly through chapter 27 this morning. And so let's get on with verse 30 there, chapter 26. You look good. Let's go. All right. Then the king rose, and the governor, and Bernice, and those who were sitting with them. And when they had withdrawn, they said to one another, "This man is doing nothing to deserve death or imprisonment." And Agrippa said to Festus, "This man could have been set free had he not appealed to Caesar." Now, before we jump into 27, which kind of tells about his journey, Paul's journey to go see Caesar, I want to remind you a little bit about what's kind of happened over the past 4, 5, 6 chapters. In chapter 20, we see that Paul's been told he has to go to Jerusalem. But Paul also knows when he goes to Jerusalem that it's not going to go well for him there. He knows that the Jews are plotting against him. They want to take care of this huge mouthpiece for Christ. And he knows this, and of course, along the way, as he's revealing this to the churches that he's planted in Ephesus and along the way, these churches are like concerned for Paul, and they're begging Paul to not go there. He said, "Your life's in danger." But Paul says, "But I have to go there. There are reasons I have to go there. God has ordained things to happen in this moment that are necessary to fulfill God's plan for taking the gospel to the world." And so they said, "Okay, then go in peace." And so he goes, and lo and behold, he understood it to be. He gets there, and the Jews have been plotting, and he gets to start speaking about what's going on with the gospel and how it's spread and whatever. And of course, the Jews are furious because number one is they're talking about Jesus, and as you all well know by now, the Jewish people who had not accepted Jesus were not very happy about this message. Through that whole process, Paul is thrown into prison. He stands before the council there, the Jewish council there, and he gets to plead his case. They find at the end of the day that he's innocent. He's not really done anything wrong. But they're not happy with that. They can't convict him on their own standards, so what do? They do the exact same thing they did to Jesus. They shoot him on over to the Romans. And the Romans are thinking, well, maybe we can take the bullet of Paul's hands off us if we figure out how the Romans might be able to take care of it, just like they thought they would do with Jesus. And so when he gets over there, they take him to before the governor, Felix. Felix examines the situation, figures out, hey, you know what? This is really a religious dispute. Really not have nothing to do here. And he goes, so you really, we're not, you know, we don't have no reason to keep you here, but he keeps him in jail anyway as kind of a favor to the Jewish leadership. But through that process, what happens is that he gives the opportunity to go back and say, well, I want you to stand before your own people and be set free. You know you're going to be set. You know you're going to be found innocent. So why don't you just go to your own people and be set free? Paul says, no. I've already sent this message to them. They've heard this message. I must go on, and this message needs to be rectified. I'm going to plead as a Roman citizen, which he was, to appeal to Caesar. And so in chapter 21, 22, he appeals to Caesar. At this point, that kind of messes with Felix. He don't know what to do with this because it's like, okay, well, this is not a big deal in either camp. It's just that these guys are trying to come up with some stuff against Paul. But now he's a little bit afraid because now he don't want to send a guy up to Caesar with some information that really Caesar has better things to deal with than to listen to this little nobody of a guy named Paul. But at the same time, though, he don't want to let him go because he knows if he lets him go and there's more stuff gets stirred up within the empire, his neck's going to be on the line. That's essentially what's going on in the passages leading up to this deal. And here's what I love about this passage because that whole story, those last 6 or 7 chapters, is that we get to see through all of this an amazing picture of God's providence. We get to see that in spite of man's better efforts, in spite of our own willing or desires to try to do things our own way, God has his own will. He has his own purposes, and he's going to fulfill them. And so this morning, as we kind of walk through chapter 27, that's what we're going to do. We're going to unfold, actually the next 2 weeks, we're going to unfold what it means to live under the providence of God. What does a believer, what does it look like for a believer who really desires to and understands and submits himself to the fact that his life doesn't count for anything except for the sovereign will of God? What is it going to look like for a life to look like that? And so that's what we're going to be talking about this week. Next week we're going to talk about the goal of providence, which is to see the gospel will never fail. See, it's not enough to say that we believe in providence and that God takes care of us. Why is he taking care of us? And we're going to deal with that topic next week. Okay? So why is it important for us to understand this topic of providence? Well, I got three reasons, and then we'll move on. First, it helps us understand why things happen the way they do. You ever wonder why a certain circumstance happens in your life and you're just befuddled because you're like, things are going well, and all of a sudden just things just out of nowhere. You get landed with some kind of, you know, odd situation. Maybe it's a horrible situation, whatever it may be. Do you ever wonder why those things happen? We all do, right? We all find ourselves in those situations all the time. And so providence, when we live under it and we understand God's timing and the way God, what God is taking us towards, we understand it helps us understand what happens, why things happen the way they do. Second is, it gives us a deeper purpose and meaning in life. And we're going to find this more and more as we unpack this passage this morning. Is that as we begin to understand that God is providentially moving, and the word there, gets, we got words for provide and provision. When God's provisionally moving through our lives, he's not doing it just for our benefit. He's doing it for the benefit of the gospel, for his glorious mission. And so when we are set on that plane, that gives us true meaning and true purpose in life. And then number three, kind of goes along with it, it ensures the success of the gospel and the mission of God. But see, here's what I find sometimes. I was kind of reflecting on this idea of providence this past week, and I find that sometimes we don't think enough about the doctrine, and not to use a heavy term there or you know, a dull term, the doctrine of providence, because sometimes we limit the idea of providence to just a very small sphere in our life. We limit it to these things. Let me give you an example. How many of you guys have ever had a flat tire on the side of the road, maybe going up 65, 24, going into town? Traffic's flying by you at a million miles an hour, and you're afraid you're going to die before you get off the road, right? And then someone amazing just kind of pulls up behind you, helps you put that tire back on. You know, because you're thinking, I'm not going to be able to do this, and I'm really kind of like scared. I'm going to keep my eye on the road, but I can't really get the tire on. But someone does stop and help you do that. Anybody's been in those situations? We rightly attribute that to the providence of God. How about you're racing to a meeting, you're late for a meeting, and you thank God that you got there on time, when in reality you should be thanking God that you didn't kill somebody on the way there because you were driving 100 miles an hour. Here's one. Have you ever had a financial need in your life? It was a very specific need in your life. And the day of, or the day after, within a few days, that exact amount comes to you by some random course. Yeah, those are providences of God. And for sure they are. But sometimes that's about the extent. I mean, I admit that's probably the extent that I see it sometimes. I mean, that providence happened to me not even a month or so ago when me and Amanda had a need, and someone in this church we don't know of met that need for us. That's amazing to us. But I want to expand our view of providence a little bit beyond those things. I want to expand our view beyond just the fun and the exciting things of the gospel and the exciting things, the positive things that happen to us, like getting money and getting needs met and getting our tires changed and all the various things that happen in those situations. I want to expand it beyond that, because what I find is if we don't, we end up living life through the lens of a very small view of God's work and mission and goals. In other words, we live in a small view of God's providence. So we reduce it. And here's why I'm going to kind of use this terminology this morning. We're going to come back to it over and over in a sermon. Is we reduce God's work in our life to the ground level. Whatever, we only see God work. We only see God work through just these limited, whatever my view can see at any given time. And what happens over time is that it becomes more of an individual thing. Our faith becomes an individual thing, which is right. We should think about it that way. But we don't expand it to seeing how those little small things in life contribute to a larger picture that God's bringing together. And he's bringing this piece together and this piece together for the good of the gospel. And so we want to do this. And here's the reason why having a small view of providence is such a big deal, is bad for us. It's because when we limit it to that sphere of life, we don't have a framework by which to plug in bad things. Because we only see it in terms of when God does good things, everything's great. when God does, or things happen to us, bad things happen to us, we're not so quickly, we don't quickly go back and attribute to God as to why those things have happened in our life, or ask God why those things have happened in our life. We don't have a framework. And so I think the remedy this morning that we're going to talk about, what we need to talk about as far as what we'll see in this story, is that we got to have both a ground view of the gospel, but we also got to have an aerial view of the gospel. Okay? The gospel moves through our life in both those spheres. It enables us to live life individually, just in this world right here, but it also helps me navigate through life in that realm, knowing that it fits a piece of something much larger from above. It allows me to see things sometimes, at times, from a bigger picture. And sometimes we limit God because we just stay right down here instead of looking from up here sometimes, the way God allows us to see that. I think the best analogy I have for this is kind of wartime. In the 20th century, wartime was revolutionized. Why? Anyone want to know? Air travel, right? Did it not change the face of military philosophy? Before this time, you were relegated to just the ground troops, and they were only limited to what they could see. And so the only advantage you had was hope to get the hills country to be able to see down onto the battlefield, so you would know when people are kind of coming in from every different directions. One of my favorite movies is The Patriot with Mel Gibson. And Benjamin Martin, Mel Gibson's character in there, is a genius when it comes to ground level military. Why? Because he doesn't buy into the whole tactics of just face-to-face combat. He takes his little militia and he causes havoc throughout the British Empire. You guys familiar with what I'm talking about? But even then, it was limited because at some point, someone's going to come up with a better plan that's going to take him out, which happened to him in that movie. So the only advantage you should have would be at the hill country, would be up here to kind of look above. Well, how much more of an advantage do we have now that we have planes flying in the sky? How much more advantage do our troops have on the ground now that Joe's brother's in flying over Afghanistan at different times? He's not there right now, but he will be back here, I think, sometime soon. He's given our troops on the ground huge advantages by being over there. Okay? It's the same exact same thing. I think this analogy is helpful to me in a couple of different ways. One is, it helps us see that life is a battle. It's wartime. Because of sin, because of the place of sin and the curse of sin on its life, is that life is a battleground. We will always fight it. We will always do war against it. We will always be in that place in our life. And if we choose not to admit that and choose not to live that way, sin will always prevail in our life. Earlier this week, me and Amanda watched the first episode of a new show called Parenthood. And Craig T. Nelson, who used to play Coach on the show Coach years ago, Craig T. Nelson is this wacky older grandfather figure who's kind of cantankerous but yet good-natured. And he's trying to teach his grandson to be kind of man up a little bit. Well, the grandson's dad, who's his son, goes to his dad and says, hey, goes to Craig T. Nelson's character and says, listen, Dad, I don't want him to always look at life as it's a battle. And in a sage, before it cuts the commercial, he goes, the son, life is a battle. And I was sitting there thinking about that in terms of this message this morning. We can grab this idea that we need both a ground assault and an aerial assault in our faith. We'll understand God's providential working through our life. We'll get a bigger view of what that looks like through our life. There's another part I think that's very helpful for us this morning is this idea that I'm sorry, I got this out of order here. Put myself out of order. Because what happens then when we have this view, if we're just living on here, we have a limited spectrum by which to live life and fight the battles God gives us. So with that being said, I want to move on into the text here. And let's just go ahead and read through it. Chapter 27, real quickly. And then we're going to draw out a few points, about 3 or 4 points this morning, and we'll head out of here. Chapter 27, verse 1. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in a ship of Adramatum, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. And the next day we put in at Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to see his friends and be cared for. And putting out to sea from there, we sailed into the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. Now, a lee of the Cyprus was basically the west coast of the island. all of your treacherous stuff was always comes in from the west. I'm sorry, it was the east coast of the island. It always came in from the west. And the east coast would give you some little bit of border from hitting all those choppy waters and stuff. So the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra at Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty at Cnidus, off of Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salmon. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near a city which was Lycia. Since much time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous because of the fast. Now, the fast he's talking about here, the fast is basically the Passover. We're talking about April. So he'd already been journeying from there. So this was probably midsummer when they started this journey. It's getting into fall at this particular point. As we get into fall at this particular point, fall is the worst time to ever travel the open seas because the waters are real choppy during that time. It was almost universally known that you didn't travel on the waters during those times because it was very dangerous. And people who did usually didn't come back. Okay? So Paul advised them due to this, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss," because Paul had traveled a lot, not only with cargo into the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than what Paul said. And because the harbor was not suitable for to spend winter in, the majority decided to put off to sea from there, and on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. They didn't want to stay in the other harbor because it really wasn't a happening town. Phoenix was a happening town. They wanted to go to a party city, is essentially what was going on here. Verse 13. "Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they would obtain their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore." They never made it to Phoenix. Here's what happened. "But soon a tempestuous wind," that is a hurricane force wind, "called a northeaster, struck down from the island." So off the mountain, this wind came blowing down off the coast, and it blew them completely off course. "And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along." Had no idea where they were going. "And running under the lee of a small island called Cauda," which is just south of Crete, "we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. And after hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on Sirtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. Since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days," this is one heck of a storm, "and no small tempest lay on us," that is, no small wind, "all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. Since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, 'Men, you should have listened to me and not set sail for Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart.'" Paul's attitude changes here. This is where we'll focus most of our attention on here in a minute. "Now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you. So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that he will do exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground at some time." So here's some situation. Paul begins the story, a little nervous about the journey. He understands in his travel time, this is not a good time to travel. He knows in his heart, he's got that human fear that goes on here. This is not going to go well. This is going to go bad for everybody involved from the very beginning. But throughout the journey, and there, he kind of sits there quietly because he could basically got outboated. He's sitting there, and they're getting tossed around. All the crew, which, by the way, we find out later was around 276 persons, okay, are getting tossed around. They're working their best to try to keep the ship on course, not knowing that at this time that this is something that God had ordained for the purposes of the gospel. Some point, we don't know when, Paul changes his heart about this situation. During the night, an angel appears to him and reminds him. Now, here's what happens. The angel reminds him that God has a purpose and he intends for Paul to go to Rome. Jesus had told him in a jail cell back in Jerusalem that you are going to go to Rome and you're going to stand before Caesar. So this angel comes in his presence and says, "Hey, look, you know, I know this looks kind of weird right now, but just know this. God has already written what is going to happen. You're going to get there. So now, use this as an opportunity for the gospel, Paul," is essentially what's going on at this point. And not anyone, and to prove the goodness of God, not anyone on this ship's going to die, regardless if they're a believer or not a believer. So this is the purpose, Paul. You're going to make it there. That's the situation. And so from there, he comes and stands before the crew and says, "So don't be afraid. Take heart, men, for I have faith in God that he will do as just as he says he will do." In this statement, there are at least four things that I have found that are very helpful to understand if we are going to be believers who live in light of God's providence. Providence, for the name Providence Baptist Fellowship, is more than just a name. It's more than just a theological term. Hopefully after this morning's sermon, you're going to see a much deeper meaning as to why we named ourselves Providence. Maybe we didn't even know it when we did. But there's at least four things here that I think are reassured to a believer when they live in light of God's providence. First one is this. Life is sweetened by the nearness of God. Life is sweetened by the nearness of God. Verse 23 says this, and 24 says this, just like we just read. "For this very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong and to whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar.'" When God intends for something to happen, and we live in light of that, and we say, "God, you have ordered my steps. You have told me and you revealed to me the direction that you want me to go," and we live in light of that, God's plans never fail. And when we live like that, God's presence becomes sweeter. It wasn't the presence of the angel that we just mentioned here. That's not the presence we're talking about. We're talking about the presence of Jesus. What did the angel's words to Paul do? It reminded him of 2.5 years earlier when he's standing in that jail cell and Jesus in flesh comes and stands in front of him and says, "You went to Jerusalem, so also you shall go to Rome. You will proclaim the gospel to the uttermost, Paul. You are my agent to do that in this generation." And to say he's going to Rome would mean that he's gone to the furthest ends of the earth, because Roman Empire was essentially the center of the earth. The Roman Empire, 3,000 years of the Roman Empire, controlled vast amounts of the earth during this time period. And to say that he was going to Rome was the indication of saying, "You're going to be my instrument at this particular generation to take the gospel to the ends of the earth." And so he was reminded in this angel's presence of Jesus' presence with him in that cell and promise that he was going to go somewhere. Paul was visited by, no doubt, by this time, and he was emboldened by this encounter. And see, here's what I think sometimes. When we live our faith, when our faith is lived only on the ground level, we lose sight of God's presence. Why? Because we don't understand why things happen the way they do. And so when things happen out of order in our life, when they don't happen according to the plan that I've drawn up, what happens is that we draw away from God ourselves. I'm going to really knock this thing over before long. We're going to be drawing ourselves away from the presence of God because God doesn't seem so strong anymore. He doesn't seem so good anymore. He doesn't seem like the provider that he is. But what we don't realize is that the word providence means to provide. Sometimes God provides the flat tire to be fixed. And sometimes he provides the right amount of money at the right amount at the right time. But sometimes God provides, and we don't understand it, but when we live with the aerial salt, we do. He provides hard times, tragedy, difficult marriages, difficult families, difficult church situations, difficult vocations. He provides all those things just at the right time. And we don't realize that those are provisions by God too. And when we don't understand that and we live on the ground level, what happens is that we don't sense the presence of God anymore because we've made God into a great butler. We've pushed God to a realm where God can be in my life as long as He's just doing the things that make sense to me and doing the good things for me. But He does. I can't embrace a God who would allow these kinds of things to happen in my life, whatever they may be. And when we only live on the ground level, that's how we're going to react most of the time. But when we understand that there is an aerial attack that's for our good. Remember, the troops on the ground are advancing the mission that they're having because the aerial attack's giving them information that they don't have without them. And so God's up here working, and He's steering, and He's molding, and He's crafting, and He's shaping this tapestry, this big artwork of a story in place for us, and we don't understand it, but if we just trust that He knows best, when those bad things happen, when those difficult situations walk into our life, here's what happens. We may not always understand it, but we just get a peace to walk in it. Because you know why? Because my God is always present. He is always near to me. The other night, I try to be home most every evening to have dinner with my family, to read the Bible and sing and pray with my kids and my wife, and then help get them ready for bed. And then Mandy takes off with Asher, and then I take off with Caleb, and I put him down to bed. And I lay down there next to his bed, and I just kind of, he's got a little toddler bed, so I obviously cannot fit in this toddler bed with him. But I'm sitting here next to the toddler bed with him. And the other night we decided we weren't going to go to bed right away. We're just going to open up the Bible again. And so he just kind of flipping through pages, and he's trying to give me commentary on the Bible as he's going through there, which you can't really understand half of what he's saying anymore. But, he's giving there and he's just talking. And every once in a while, he knows what he's talking about. But I don't know what he's talking about, but he knows what he's talking about. He closes the Bible without any, prodding from me. He lays down and says he's ready to go to bed. Pulls the covers up over him. I get up, I pull the Bible, put it up under his bed. I get up to go turn the fan on. We put a fan in for a noise barrier. And I go turn the light off, and he goes, "Daddy, don't turn the light off." I said, "Why, son? You know we got to turn the light off." And you go, you can't go night-night without turning the light off. He goes, "Daddy, don't turn the light off." He goes, "I can't see you." And I said, "Son, you'll know I'm there. You'll know I'm there because I'll have my hand on you. And I'll have my arms around you. You'll know I'm there. Even in the darkest of night, in the places you can't see, you'll know I'm there, son." And I just started thinking about that. I'm getting broken up right now. I was sitting there, I almost broke out in tears in the darkness there with my son trying to fall asleep. And I started thinking, what an amazing picture of a God. Sometimes when it's dark in our life, He still has His arms around us. He's still present when we choose to walk in Him, regardless of how tough things can be sometimes. First point, life is sweetened by the nearness of God. Second point, life is satisfied in the ownership of God. Life is satisfied in the ownership of God. When we truly know God's providence, we feel true, deep, lasting satisfaction in life. Why? Because satisfaction is not dependent on my success. Satisfaction is not dependent on how well things go for me. Satisfaction is dependent on the fact that I am owned by a great, big God. Paul knew this. He understood this. Look again at the same verses here. He says right here in verse 24, I'm sorry, in verse 23, "Do not, for this very night there is stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong," of a God to whom I belong. Paul knew it. He understood it. He belongs to a great, majestic, sovereign God who does good for His people. He understood that in the midst of this thing, this ship is breaking apart. It is tearing apart as He speaks. But He knew it. He knew His God would triumph. He knew God's purposes would triumph. And He knew the only reason His life meant anything was to be owned and to be operated by God. And so if God chose that night to trade in Paul for a newer model, so be it. But he also knew that God had revealed to him and told him that there was some other place. And so his confidence was drawn close. He was satisfied in the ownership of God. He says it better than anybody else in his letter to 2 Corinthians. He says this, "Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you receive from God?" And here's the best part. "You are not your own. You are bought with a price." Paul knew that he was created and owned for the purposes of Christ. But again, on the ground level, that's hard to reconcile, isn't it? When all you looking around is looking at just what kind of impacts me and how it affects me, it's hard to understand the ownership of God because we live most of life for ourselves, making decisions for ourselves, for our families, for our benefit, for our jobs, however that may look like in our lives. And it's hard to reconcile that in that life. When we continue to live in a ground level faith only, this is what I wrote down, faith is reduced to me. It makes me happy. What makes me happy? How can I get ahead, or how can I be blessed? How can I do better or get a better job? Faith becomes ultimately about me and my individual needs, not how it filters into the larger scheme of God's divine plan. That segues nicely because God's divine plan is that the gospel, which we'll talk about next week, will not fail. God's mission will not fail. That's God's divine plan. And every one of our small stories is a piece of that larger story that God will see us to the end with. Okay? That filters into our third point. Life then burns for the mission of God. Life burns for the mission of God. When we truly know God's providences, we get lit. And I'm not talking about in the drunk kind of way. We get lit. Okay? All right? We get placed on fire. It's just like Joe mentioned here, I don't know if it was last week or a couple weeks ago, is that there's something about when we set ourselves on fire, people will come watch you burn. When you do things ridiculously out of order from the way life, people interpret life to be and what's really truly beneficial to your life, and it doesn't make sense to everyone else, but it looks like dangerous decisions that you're making for the cause of Christ, and it looks like you're just putting your life on the edge of the cliff and you're about ready to walk over it, people will come watch that. We have a sick and twisted generation who loves to watch people die. They love, why don't we watch the news? We watch the news for the bad stories, not the good ones. If it was not the case, then why does the news focus so much on the negative and the positive? Oh, they'll throw you a little bone at the end of every newscast, about a 5-minute bone of some positive story about some woman who saved some puppies somewhere. All right? But the majority of that newscast, besides the weather, is negative. Because we love it. We will watch someone go down in flames. And here's what Paul's talking about here. A life lived for God's mission is a life lit on fire, and people love to watch a fire burn. He understood that. Going back to our text, verse 23. Again, he goes, let me see one more final place here. "Do not be afraid." I'm sorry, go back up here. "For the angel who stood before me was an angel of God, whom I belong and to whom I serve." See it? Whom I serve. Whom I've given my life to. He not only owns it, but he operates it as well. He's given everything. "I've given everything to you." Since Paul's radical encounter with Jesus on the road to Emmaus, some 4 years earlier at this point, or maybe 5 years earlier at this point, Jesus had one glorious goal for his life. Paul had one glorious goal for his life, and that was Jesus. To preach Christ crucified. That was Paul's aim, and that's what Paul aimed to do until the day he died. A professor I had at Southern Seminary wrote in one of his books, says it well, Paul was first and foremost a missionary. I want us to understand something. This is something that's a big, big, big piece of the puzzle for us here. We don't understand theology unless we understand that it's born out of the context of mission. Let me say that again. We don't really understand our own theology, our own doctrines, unless we know it's born out of the context of mission. See, people will rightly say that Paul was the greatest theologian ever to walk the face of this earth besides Jesus. That's true. But where did all that theology come from? What context did it come from? Planting churches all over Rome. And he wrote letters to these churches to encourage them, to give them the right perspective, the right beliefs that they needed in their life. And he wrote these kind of things. So what we need to understand is that When you live under the providence of God, you recognize that your life is for one purpose and one purpose only, to accomplish the mission of God, to spread the gospel to all peoples of all times and all places. Paul was first a missionary, then a theologian. The theology that matters for you and me is not the theology that we profess, but the theology that we practice. The theology that matters is not the theology we profess, but the theology that we practice. Four, life rests in the trust of God. Life rests in the trust of God. When we truly live within the providences of God, we don't just worry about things the way we used to worry about things anymore, do we? You know it. You know if you have, and you know if you haven't. You know if you're an overly anxious person or if you're not an overly anxious person. You just rest in something greater than yourself. When we live our life under the providences of God, we live our life with a different perspective that lessens anxiety in a lot of cases. And it just helps us rest and trust God. God has a desired end. It's going to happen. What an amazing truth for us. When God says something's going to happen, Paul knew this, it's going to happen. What did he say? Verse 24. Do not be afraid, Paul. This is what the words of the angel said to him. You must stand before Caesar. You must stand before Caesar. When you're given that kind of vision for the future, and you know the end is certain. Right, let me give you an example. How many of you guys have made a job change in the last 5 years? I have. I made a couple of them, actually. When you make a job change and you're in that process of talking to that church, like for me, when I was talking to Tusculum a couple years ago, when it was certain and we nailed it down, boy, there's a peace. And you can start acting on that peace, can't you? Because it's been revealed to you. You know where you're going. You know where you're heading. God's revealed it to you, right? Even though it's going to be a month or 2 months or whatever, how long it takes to transition into that new job or to that new area, you just know. And you can act in a different way. You act with peace. And this is what God's trying to tell us is that, look, I have a great plan. If there's a kingdom I'm building one day, and all you have to do is go proclaim my good name to all people so that there are going to be tons and thousands and hundreds and millions, whatever, of people going and inhabit that kingdom one day. That's it. If you live in light of that, there's a great confidence that no matter what happens to you in the meantime, God wins. The gospel wins. And I love this because this is what's amazing about this whole situation is we get to see how our will and God's sovereign will intertwine. My decisions matter. Your decisions matter. Those words that were given to Paul were there to encourage him to continue to fight for the ship, to continue to go down the road. They matter. But at the same time, they matter because God's already set the times and places for which his will be unfolded. It's a mystery for us. But what a wonderful mystery it is. As we leave here this morning, I just wonder, do we really get providence? Do we really get it? Do we really understand it? I don't. I live most days on the ground view only, not the aerial assault in mind. And as we walk into the table here in just a minute, I'm gonna go ahead and have my men who are gonna help serve this morning. Would y'all go ahead and come on forward? You guys just have a seat here in the front here until we get ready to start. We'll go into prayer. But I just wonder, as we're walking through this, we walk through life, do we live it in view of God's providence? Does it produce a sense of God's presence? Does it produce a sense of God's ownership? Does it produce a burning fervor for his mission? Does it produce a rest, a peace that should prevail all believers, that should consume all believers as they walk through this life? Has it done that for you? There's one amazing story here that I want to, before we walk out of here, we didn't read all the way down through here, but at the dawn, at the end of this storm. This storm is getting kind of choppy. And it had been choppy for a long time, but it's starting to kind of lessen. And Paul urges the men to take something to eat. You haven't eaten in many days. I mean, who could hold down food in the midst of this ship being tossed to and fro, right? So Paul encourages them to eat. And I love what he does here. He says, "Therefore, I urge you to take some food. It will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from your head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took the bread, he gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. Now, of course, this is not the Lord's Supper we're talking about here this morning. But I think it's as good as we get moving into the Lord's Supper. Look, the rest of those guys are on the ship. They're thinking, this guy's kind of weird. You mean something stood before you? We didn't see him. Told you that we're not going to die tonight. And Paul, now, because of that, has leverage with these guys. And now they're just kind of sitting there. And he's like, and they urge, and they did. They all took something to eat. He got to show the gospel through his life by breaking this bread and showing dependence on God. And giving God thanks for the blessings. Giving God thanks for the provisions of their life. Giving God thanks for allowing them to see themselves through this incredibly tremendous storm. And he broke that bread. And he gave it. Yeah, you know, he started eating it. And I can imagine people just started taking it. And there was just a sense of... And I have to believe Paul. I mean, he doesn't say this here implicitly in this passage. I have to believe that he used that as an opportunity to share the gospel. And I have to believe that the 276 passengers that are on that boat that night, a lot of them are standing in glory today. Because they got to see the gospel lived out through his life because of understanding how God providentially works through our life. I'm going to pray. And then these gentlemen are going to come up here and they're going to distribute the bread and the juice. But as you're distributing this, as you're getting this and distributing it, you're sitting there contemplating, will you just take some time to ask yourself, does my life reflect this kind of peace? Does my life reflect that I'm owned by God? Does my life reflect that I am living for His mission? I think that's purely applicable. Because see, when Jesus stood before His disciples and He broke bread and He gave them the wine, here's what Jesus said. He said, "You do this in remembrance of me." Remembrance of what? Me. I'm the one who suffered the most here. And I did it for your behalf. Do you trust me? Do you love me? Are you willing to follow me? Are you willing to embrace the mission? Let's pray. John, you guys go ahead and stand up. Father, we just thank you, God, for this morning. Thank you for this message. We thank you for this word. God, as much as it might be very like a fire hydrant thrown into our hearts and minds this morning, I pray, God, this morning that we see you with all your splendor and all your glory, and we see Jesus, and our affections are lit on fire for him and his glory and for his goodness. And God, that we would live life differently as we walk away from this place this morning. And God, that when we take the bread and we take the juice this morning, God, that we are taking it with a different heart and a different mind. And Father, I just pray that, God, as we distribute these things this morning, that we'll just take some time just to reflect, to be by ourselves, and to think deeply about the goodness of God and how He never fails. Goodness of Jesus and how you never fail. We love you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.